Quran and the Sunnah, whether it is death, whether it is stoning for adultery, whatever it is, if it is from Allah and His Messenger, that is the best punishment ever possible for humankind, and that is what we should apply in the world. Who agrees with that? Nearly everyone in the crowd raised a hand. And what about our closest ally, Great Britain? A Muslim leader there, who seeks to bring Sharia law to England, declared that homosexuals should be stoned to death in accordance with Islamic law. As if this weren't enough to blow up the false equivalency argument for good, it is also worth addressing one of the apologists' most beloved topics, the Crusades. Everyone from Karen Armstrong to President Barack Obama, who famously reminded an audience at the National Prayer Breakfast that people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ, have used the Crusades to equate Islam with Christianity. The Crusades did not happen in a historical vacuum. They were, in fact, part of what New York Times columnist Ross Douthat called the incredibly complicated multi-century story of medieval Christendom's conflict with Islam. Muslim armies had launched plenty of crusade-like, or more accurately, jihadist efforts against Europe, both before and after the generally accepted period of Christian crusading. Part of that period overlapped with the Reconquista, a centuries-long effort to expel Islamic invaders from modern-day Spain and Portugal, which they had controlled since the 8th century AD. Some scholars maintain that without centuries of crusading effort, it is difficult to see how Western Europe could have escaped conquest by Muslim armies. During the 4 centuries between Muhammad's death and the First Crusade, Islamic warriors and navies launched offensives around the Mediterranean against European forces, including as far away as France. The Crusades were as much a reaction to the Islamic Jihad as anything else. But even the Crusades didn't stop the fighting for good. The ongoing back-and-forth conflict between Christian and Muslim kingdoms continued for centuries, right up until the Ottoman Empire was held back from seizing Vienna in 1683. In fact, radical Islamists' penchant for referring to Americans as crusaders today suggests that, at least in their mind, the conflict may still be going on. Lie number 3. Jihad is a peaceful, internal struggle, not a war against infidels. Jihad as struggle pertains to the difficulty and complexity of living a good life. Struggling against the evil in oneself, to be virtuous and moral, making a serious effort to do good works and help to reform society. John Esposito, Georgetown University. Jihad is a personal commitment to service, patience, determination, and taking the higher road. As such, it tasks us with confronting our own weaknesses, vices, and shortcomings. It is about taking personal responsibility. My Jihad Campaign, 2012. Many Muslims and Islamic scholars consider the more correct definition of jihad refers to the inner struggle to do good and follow God's teaching. Muslims strive to attain this every day. Salon.com, 2013. Jihad is a holy struggle, a legitimate tenet of Islam, meaning to purify oneself or one's community. John Brennan, Deputy NSC Advisor, 2010. Within hours of the September 11th attacks, most Americans had heard the word jihad. Major television networks and internet sites showed video of a confident Osama bin Laden declaring that his terrorist organization was on a mission to destroy the United States. Jihad had come to America. Nearly 15 years later, this exotic Arabic word has become frighteningly familiar. And yet there are still many across the world engaged in a massive effort to disassociate the word jihad from what we can see with our own eyes, the aggressive war underway against non-Muslims. A 2003 article in National Geographic, for example, quoted Maher Hatout, the author of Jihad versus Terrorism, in an effort to set the record straight about jihad. Hatout concluded that jihad refers to a range of activities all based on the Arabic meaning of the word exerted effort. In the Quran, it's projected as exerting effort to change oneself and also, in certain situations, physically standing against oppressors if that's the only way. In late 2012, Ahmed Rihab, the director of the Chicago branch of the Hamas-linked Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, began a public relations campaign to rebrand the concept of jihad in the United States. He started by taking advantage of a sympathetic media, and once he had the support of donors behind him, plastered buses in major American cities with smiling Muslims testifying to their personal, nonviolent jihads. Rehab explains on his website, myjihad.com, "Jihad is a personal commitment to service, patience, determination, and taking the higher road. As such, it tasks us with confronting our own weaknesses, vices, and shortcomings. It is about taking personal responsibility." Georgetown University professor John Esposito is one of the more prominent of those who have made a good living as an apologist for jihad. From his perch as the director of the lavishly Saudi-funded Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding, Esposito has become a prominent figure in the media as a consultant to government officials. His post-9/11 book, What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam, set the tone for much of the confusion about the true meaning of jihad. "Jihad as struggle pertains to the difficulty and complexity of living a good life," he wrote. "Struggling against the evil in oneself to be virtuous and moral, making a serious effort to do good works and help to reform society." When Esposito isn't busy telling Americans what he thinks we need to know about Islam, he has served as a character witness and cheerleader for the Muslim Brotherhood, both in the United States and abroad. In a letter to a judge, he referred to now-deported Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader Sami al-Arian as an extraordinarily bright, articulate scholar and intellectual activist, a man of conscience with a strong commitment to peace and social justice. Despite Esposito's reviews, al-Arian himself confessed to his extensive involvement with the Brotherhood, a State Department-designated Palestinian terrorist organization. Just as alarmingly, Esposito has expressed admiration for the chief jurist of the Muslim Brotherhood, Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi. He wrote glowingly of the Sheikh's reformist interpretation of Islam and its relationship to democracy, pluralism, and human rights. This is the same Qaradawi who, in January 2009, called on Muslims to put the Jews in their place as Hitler had done. "Throughout history," Qaradawi said, "Allah has imposed upon the Jews people who would punish them for their corruption. The last punishment was carried out by Hitler, by means of all the things he did to them. Even though they exaggerated this issue, he managed to put them in their place. This was divine punishment for them. Allah willing, the next time will be at the hands of the believers." Thankfully, we don't have to depend on Georgetown professors of Islamic studies or bloggers or even presidents to understand what jihad really is. We can discover the truth ourselves in primary Islamic sources. We can and must read what Muslims read about their own religion. When we finally make an effort to look, we find that Islamic law is remarkably clear about jihad. In order to bolster Americans' impression of jihad as a peaceful, internal struggle, apologists refer to a single statement attributed to Muhammad in a hadith. It is the distinction between the nonviolent greater jihad and lesser jihad, which means warfare. The hadith, while authoritative in Islam, does not carry the same weight as the Quran itself, which is believed to be from Allah alone. One of the most recognized and honored scholars of Islamic law, Ibn Taymiyyah, explained the difference between the two jihads and shattered the idea that jihad is anything but holy war against the infidel. There is a hadith related by a group of people which states that the Prophet said after the Battle of Tabuk, "We have returned from Jihad Askar, lesser jihad, to Jihad Akbar, greater jihad." This hadith has no source, nobody whomsoever in the field of Islamic knowledge has narrated it. Jihad against the disbelievers is the most noble of actions, and moreover, it is the most important action for the sake of mankind. Still, even if an apologist will concede Taymiyyah's point that Muhammad never made a distinction between the lesser jihad and greater jihad, they will insist that according to Islamic law, Allah will countenance only a defensive jihad. Jihad, they argue, is justifiable only once Muslim lands are attacked or Muslims are being persecuted. Sufi author Kabir Helminski writes in the Huffington Post that according to Islam, fighting is allowed only in self-defense, and it is only against those who actively fight against you. He continues, yet Islam is not a pacifist religion. It does accept the premise that from time to time, and as a last resort, arms must be taken up in a just war. That sounds peaceful and moderate enough, right? Who'd argue with the right of a people to self-defense? Or with having to fight a just war reluctantly as a last resort? The Reliance of the Traveler, the classic manual of Islamic sacred law, or Umdat al-Salik in Arabic, was composed in the 14th century by Shihabuddin Abu al-Abbas Ahmad ibn an-Naqib al-Misri. It is a one-volume authoritative summation of Islamic law from one of its major schools of jurisprudence called Shafi'i. Despite its age, it is the single most popular handbook of Islamic law in the United States and a leading authority throughout the world. It was translated into English because so many Muslims in America and elsewhere don't speak classical Arabic. In fact, Reliance is the first Islamic legal work in a European language to receive certification from the most important seat of Sunni Islamic jurisprudence, Cairo's Al-Azhar University. In addition, its opening pages contain a similar endorsement from the Muslim Brotherhood's think tank in the United States, the International Institute of Islamic Thought. Reliance's section on jihad is located in Chapter 9, Justice. It states, jihad means to war against non-Muslims and is etymologically derived from the word mujahada, signifying warfare to establish the religion. And it is the lesser jihad. The entry on jihad gets even more explicit when Reliance outlines the scriptural basis for jihad in three definitive verses from Muhammad in the Quran. 1. Fighting is prescribed for you, Quran 2:216. 2. Slay them wherever you find them, Quran 4:89. 3. Fight the idolaters utterly, Quran 9:36. As these commands are in the Quran itself, Muslims believe they originated with Allah and as such are obligatory. Reliance then goes on to reference justifications for jihad warfare in the two most authoritative hadith collections, Bukhari and Muslim, which relate what Muhammad himself said. I have been commanded to fight people until they testify that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and perform the prayer and pay zakat. If they say it, they have saved their blood and possessions from me, except for the rights of Islam over them. And their final reckoning is with Allah. After looking at Islamic law, jihad turns out to be an exhortation to real physical violence. It is as well a command to plunder the possessions of those who do not testify that there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah and perform the prayer and pay zakat, or in other words, become a Muslim. This interpretation of jihad is supported by numerous other authoritative sources written by Islamic scholars. Ibn Khaldun, one of classical Islam's most prominent scholars, discussed the meaning and goal of jihad as a holy war and contrasted it with the aspirations of other religions or nations in his revered text, Muqaddima. In the Muslim community, the holy war is a religious duty because of the universalism of the Muslim mission and the obligation to convert everybody to Islam either by persuasion or by force. The other religious groups did not have a universal mission, and the holy war was not a religious duty for them, save only for purposes of defense. Among them, royal authority comes to those who have it by accident, and in some way, that has nothing to do with religion. It comes to them as the necessary result of group feeling, which by its very nature seeks to obtain royal authority, as we have mentioned before, and not because they are under obligation to gain power over other nations, as is the case with Islam. They are merely required to establish their religion among their own people. In the 1930s, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, wrote a pamphlet on the centrality of jihad. Jihad is an obligation from Allah on every Muslim and cannot be ignored nor evaded. Allah has ascribed great importance to jihad and has made the reward of the martyrs and the fighters in his way a splendid one. Only those who have acted similarly and who have modeled themselves upon the martyrs in their performance of jihad can join them in this reward. Furthermore, Allah has specifically honored the mujahideen with certain exceptional qualities, both spiritual and practical, to benefit them in this world and the next. Their pure blood is a symbol of victory in this world and the mark of success and felicity in the world to come. Islam is concerned with the question of jihad and the drafting and the mobilization of the entire global Muslim community into one body to defend the right cause with all its strength than any other ancient or modern system of living, whether religious or civil. The verses of the Quran and the Sunnah of Muhammad, PBUH, are overflowing with all these noble ideas, and they summon people in general with the most eloquent expression and the clearest exposition to jihad, to warfare, to the armed forces, and all means of land and sea fighting. Some Muslim scholars, like India's Maulana Waris Mazari, acknowledge that it is clear that traditional understandings of jihad are urgently in need of careful scrutiny, study, and revision. He writes, "The majority of Islamic jurists and Quranic commentators, Mufassirin, consider war to be the real basis of relations between Muslims and non-Muslims. They regard the infidelity of non-Muslims as the cause, ilat, of such war. They believe that Muslims must engage in war with non-Muslims continuously till Islam establishes its supremacy over all other religions. Since in actual fact this, as Muslims believe, can only happen just before the Day of Judgment, they argue that Muslims must necessarily continue to wage war against non-Muslims till the Day of Judgment finally arrives." The opinion of Imam Shafi'i and some other Islamic jurists is even more extreme in this regard. They argue that only Ahl-e Kitab, or people of the book, can be permitted to stay alive in exchange for paying the jizya, and that all other non-Muslims must accept either Islam or death. Osama bin Laden, Hamas, the Islamic State, Boko Haram, Hezbollah, and every other Muslim terrorist group justify what they do by claiming they are fighting a defensive jihad. They believe the goal of Islam is to spread its system of law across the world. Therefore, any opposition to spreading Islamic law could be defined as a defensive act. In 1998, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda issued a statement to the West and to the Muslim world, declaring a defensive jihad against the United States. It was called the Declaration of Jihad Against Jews and Crusaders, World Islamic Front. Notice as you listen how important it is for Al-Qaeda to back up everything they say with references to figures that Muslims would consider authoritative or legally binding. "All these crimes and sins committed by the Americans are a clear declaration of war on Allah, His Messenger, and Muslims. And ulema have throughout Islamic history unanimously agreed that the jihad is an individual duty if the enemy destroys the Muslim countries." This was revealed by Imam bin Qadama in Al-Mughni, Imam al-Kisai in al-Badai, al-Qurtubi in his interpretation, and the Sheikh of al-Islam in his books, where he said, "As for the fighting to repulse an enemy, it is aimed at defending sanctity and religion, and it is a duty as agreed by the Islamic scholars. Nothing is more sacred than belief except repulsing an enemy who is attacking religion and life." Bin Laden and the Islamic authorities he relies on are in fact referencing Quran 5:33, which reads, "The recompense of those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and do mischief in the land is only that they shall be killed or crucified, or their hands and their feet be cut off on the opposite sides, or be exiled from the land. That is their disgrace in this world, and a great torment is theirs in the hereafter." After the 1991 Gulf War, the United States, at Saudi Arabia's invitation, stationed armed forces in Saudi Arabia to ensure that Saddam Hussein wouldn't again attempt to annex one of Iraq's neighbors. But that wasn't how bin Laden viewed America's actions. He and al-Qaeda charged America with attacking religion and life in these Muslim-controlled lands. Lebanon's late Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, a Shia, defined the nature of the defensive jihad in terms the al-Qaeda leader would certainly approve of. Jihad in Islam, the violent confrontation of the enemy, is the fighting movement that aims at preventing the enemy from forcing its hegemony over the land and the people by means of violence that confiscates freedom, kills the people, usurps the wealth, and prevents the people's rights in self-determination. Therefore, jihad is confronting violence by means of violence and force by force, which makes it of a defensive nature at times and a preventative one at others. In the light of this, jihad is no different than any human and civilized concept of self-defense. It expresses the innate human nature of self-defense, or preventing the others from building the ability for a sudden aggression. There is also the case of defending the downtrodden, who are prosecuted by the arrogant and who have no means of defending themselves. As Fadlallah made clear, there are plenty of things that Islamic law considers cause for defensive jihad. If Muslims in non-Islamic societies are not permitted by the authorities to live their lives according to Sharia, with all its mandatory anti-democratic and outdated rules, it could be considered persecution of the Muslim community. This is a very broad definition that leaves plenty of room for interpretation and justification of defensive jihad. For example, the killers who massacred the staff of the irreverent satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris did not believe they were taking an offensive action. They believed they were actually defending the reputation of Islam's prophet from those who attacked it. More important, though, they believed they were informing the world of the Sharia-prescribed penalty for mocking or questioning Muhammad, and thereby dissuading others from following suit. Even Islamic authorities that are identified as moderate by academics and the media, like Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the Hitler-praising Muslim Brotherhood leader and Al Jazeera talk show superstar, accept this rationale for defensive jihad. Qaradawi is the most influential living Sunni imam. His program, Sharia and Life, has an estimated audience of some 60 million throughout the Muslim world. In 2011, Qaradawi famously issued a fatwa outlining the Islamic standard for jihad, including to ensure the freedom to propagate the call to Islam and to remove the physical obstacles which prevent the call to Islam from reaching the multitudes of people. This was the reason for the conquest of the rightly guided, caliphs, and the companions of the Prophet, as well as those who followed them in righteousness. They fought to remove the power of the tyrants who controlled the necks and minds of men. This is a very loose standard, and it could apply in a multitude of scenarios where there is any kind of obstacle to mass conversion to Islam, real or imagined. The same logic applies to blasphemy, ridicule, or anything else our First Amendment permits that influential voices like Qaradawi might believe interferes with the call to Islam. Mocking Muhammad in a cartoon, speaking out against Islamic law, or even writing this book to expose the truth, all could be considered acts that might prevent Americans from converting to Islam, which is the Islamists' goal, and justify violent acts of jihad. Individual Muslims may have their own peaceful, internal jihads of spiritual and personal growth, but that shouldn't be used to obscure the real threat of violent jihad. Apologists focus on the former in order to make sure we never learn about the latter. Islamic law defines jihad to mean war against non-Muslims and warfare to establish the religion, and it is the traditional Sharia meaning of the term that has been a consistent part of Islamic doctrine from Muhammad until today. Lie number four. Muslims don't actually seek to live under Sharia, let alone impose it on others. There are so many different interpretations of it anyway. In a broad sense, Sharia law is the code of conduct or religious law of Islam. It is a wide-ranging system that encompasses crime, politics, economic and personal matters such as sexuality, diet, hygiene, prayer, and fasting. There is no one document that outlines a universally agreed-upon use of Sharia. This leads to many different interpretations. Council on American Islamic Relations. There are so many varying interpretations of what Sharia actually means that in some places it can be incorporated into political systems relatively easily. Stephen A. Cook, Council on Foreign Relations. In an effort to appear tolerant and understanding of Islam, the George Soros-funded Center for American Progress enlisted former Muslim Student Association activist Wajahat Ali to draft a 7-page paper titled Understanding Sharia Law. In it, Ali writes, "There is no one thing called Sharia. A variety of Muslim communities exist, and each understands Sharia in its own way. No official document, such as the Ten Commandments, encapsulates Sharia. It is the ideal law of God as interpreted by Muslim scholars over centuries aimed toward justice, fairness, and mercy." He went on to conclude, "In reality, Sharia is personal religious law and moral guidance for the vast majority of Muslims. Muslim scholars historically agree on certain core values of Sharia, which are theological and ethical and not political. Moreover, these core values are in harmony with the core values at the heart of America." Lawyer and author Kasim Rashid, writing in the Huffington Post, repeatedly stresses that Sharia seeks a society based on justice, pluralism, and equity for every member of that society, and that Sharia would not allow these dictates to be imposed on any unwilling person. First, let's understand what Sharia is. It is a codification of the rules of the lifestyle, or deen, ordained by Allah, the perfect expression of His divine will and justice. Therefore, it is the supreme law over everything and everyone, regardless of where that individual may live. There isn't a corner of life that Sharia doesn't touch. It governs and dictates everything. Sharia comes from four principal sources: the Quran, the Sunnah or Hadith, Ijma, and Qiyas. By now you're already familiar with the central sacred text of Islam and the example and practices of Muhammad's life as relayed in the oral traditions of the Hadith. Ijma means consensus and consists of the prevailing opinion of Muslim scholars. Qiyas is reasoning by analogy, which establishes new precedents in areas where the Quran and Hadith are unclear. Islam, it is generally acknowledged, is a complete way of life, writes Imran Asan Khan Niazi, a leading professor of Islamic law at the International Islamic University, Islamabad. And at the core of the code is the law of Islam. No other sovereign or authority is acceptable to the Muslim unless it guarantees the application of the laws, Sharia, in their entirety. Any other legal system, howsoever attractive it may appear on the surface, is alien from Muslims, and it is not likely to succeed in the solution of their problems. It would be doomed from the start. This is the root of political Islam, or what we are calling Islamism. It is the belief shared by millions of Muslims that Sharia is the answer to the world's ills, and represents the holistic worldview of Muhammad and the Quran. It's not surprising, then, that a 2013 Pew poll of nearly 40,000 Muslims in 39 countries demonstrated widespread support for the adoption of Sharia law. Support for Sharia, percentage of Muslims who favor making Sharia the official law in their country. Afghanistan, 99%. Iraq, 91%. Palestinian territories, 89%. Malaysia, 86%. Pakistan, 84%, Morocco, 83%, Bangladesh, 82%, Thailand, 77%, Egypt, 74%, Indonesia, 72%, Jordan, 71%, Russia, 42%. That overwhelming numbers of Muslims should want to live under Islamic law should come as no surprise, especially as we learn more about Islam's goals and underpinnings. For Muslims living under the law, deen of Allah, which encompasses everything from family law to business and transactional law to international law and more, is a defined religious imperative. In Islam, a Sacred Law, What Every Muslim Should Know About the Sharia, author Faisal Abdul Rauf, the imam at the center of the Ground Zero mosque controversy, describes what Islamic law is. Since Sharia is understood as a law with God at its center, it is not possible in principle to limit the Sharia to some aspect of human life and leave out others. The Sharia thus covers every field of law, public and private, national and international, together with enormous amounts of material that Westerners would not regard as law at all, because the basis of Sharia is the worship and obedience to God through good works and moral behavior. Following the sacred law thus defines the Muslim's belief in God. Rauf is what the media describes as a moderate. He matter-of-factly describes that Islamic law traverses the distance between personal religious observance or theology and laws that affect others in the public sphere. As we'll see, our constitution comes into conflict with Islamic law in numerous places. In Sharia, the Islamic law, renowned Muslim professor Abdur Rahman Doi explains why Muslims in the Middle East and elsewhere feel pressure to want to live according to Sharia. The Holy Quran has warned those who fail to apply the Sharia in the following strong words. And if any fail to judge by the light of what Allah has revealed, they are not better than those who rebel. 5:50. And if any fail to judge by the light of what Allah has revealed, they are no better than wrongdoers. 5:48. And if any fail to judge by the light of what Allah has revealed, they are no better than unbelievers. 5:47. There's one thing that unites every single one of the world's Islamic terror groups, from Boko Haram to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, from Hezbollah to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and from the Muslim Brotherhood to freelance jihadists plotting murder in America. The desire to make Sharia the law of the land everywhere on earth. You'd be hard-pressed to find a letter, press release, tweet, or Facebook post from any militant Islamic group that doesn't mention the imperative of imposing Sharia, first in Muslim-controlled lands and then across the globe. The pronouncements of other Islamist leaders suggest that the spread of Sharia is indeed the clear goal. When ISIS declared a caliphate in 2014, it declared its mission as compelling the people to do what the Sharia, Allah's law, requires of them concerning their interests in the hereafter and worldly life, which can only be achieved by carrying out the command of Allah, establishing His religion and referring to His law for judgment. In 2002, Osama bin Laden declared, "Muslims, and especially the learned among them, should spread Sharia law to the world, that and nothing else. Not laws under the umbrella of justice, morality, and rights, as understood by the masses. No, the Sharia of Islam is the foundation. In fact, Muslims are obligated to raid the lands of the infidels, occupy them, and exchange their system of governance for an Islamic system, barring any practice that contradicts Sharia from being publicly voiced among the people, as was the case in the dawn of Islam. They say that our Sharia does not impose our particular beliefs upon others. This is a false assertion, for it is in fact part of our religion to impose our particular beliefs upon others. Thus, whoever refuses the principle of terror against the enemy also refuses the commandment of Allah, the Exalted, the Most High, and His Sharia. And we also stress to honest Muslims that in the midst of such momentous events, and in this heated atmosphere, they must move, incite, and mobilize the Muslim Ummah to liberate itself from being enthralled to these unjust and apostate ruling regimes, who themselves are enslaved to America, and to establish the Sharia of Allah on earth." Even as it was being courted by the Obama administration, the Muslim Brotherhood was honest about its long-standing goals for installing Sharia worldwide, declaring in 2010, "The Muslim Brotherhood is an international Muslim body which seeks to establish Allah's law in the land by achieving the spiritual goals of Islam in the true religion." Of course, none of this is new. Pakistani Abdul Al-Madudi, the founder of Jamaat-e-Islami, the largest Islamic organization in Asia, gave a 1939 speech titled Jihad in Islam, in which he spoke clearly about the goal of installing Islamic law worldwide. "The objective of the Islamic Jihad is to eliminate the rule of an un-Islamic system and establish in its stead an Islamic system of state rule. Islam does not intend to confine this revolution to a single state or a few countries. The aim of Islam is to bring about a universal revolution. No revolutionary ideology which champions the principles of the welfare of humanity as a whole, instead of upholding national interests, can restrict its aims and objectives to the limits of a country or a nation. The goal of such an all-embracing doctrine is naturally bound to be world revolution." Like so many prominent jihadists, Maududi was no outcast. He was not only one of the most influential imams of the 20th century, he was also an internationally recognized Islamic scholar who wrote scores of books, including The Meaning of the Quran, a popular single-volume commentary widely available in America. At the same time, he was a fierce, self-described revolutionary who, in no uncertain terms, sought the overthrow of all non-Muslim forms of government worldwide. Nearly every article or news report in the Western media about the Islamic State in Iraq or Syria, Boko Haram in Africa, or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, remarks on the application of Sharia in these places, most often in the context of horrific and medieval Sharia-mandated punishments for criminal offenses. Whenever these atrocities are mentioned, we hear Islamic law described as severe versions of Sharia. The journalists and so-called experts want us to believe there are gradations of Islamic law. The bad guys force the severe kind on unwilling populations, while moderate or even liberal interpretations are just as valid and practiced by the vast majority of the world's Muslims. But we know that's not the truth. There is only one version of Sharia, and a great many Muslims around the world will not stop until we are all living under it. Lie number 5. America is safe from Sharia law. Sharia is as unthreatening to the U.S. legal system as the ideas in the Old Testament. Yet bigoted hysteria is fueling legislation that actually undermines our courts, the nation. There is no evidence that Islamic law is encroaching on our courts, American Civil Liberties Union. On the front of the United States Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. are emblazoned the words, "Equal justice under law." Though our justice system is not always perfect, we strive to make sure our courts hold every individual, regardless of his or her background, equally accountable to the laws enshrined in our Constitution and passed by our elected representatives. So, what if an American judge sided with foreign religious law that insisted on inequality between believer and non-believer instead of our own legal codes? What if you were subjected to an entirely separate shadow legal system? It admittedly seems like a fevered delusion that this could ever happen in the United States, but it's closer than you think. Islamic Sharia law has been slowly integrating itself into American society and our justice system. There is a frantic scramble on the left to respond to those warning of the dangers of American Sharia with two tactics, calling people conspiracy theorists and calling them Islamophobes. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, manages to do both. The ACLU issued a report on Sharia in America with the less than reassuring title, "Nothing to Fear." In it, they assert that there is no evidence that Islamic law is encroaching on our courts. Cases involving Sharia, they claim, are simply routine legal matters. Those who have a problem with Sharia influencing American justice are automatically anti-Muslim advocates, whose goal is not to preserve liberty, but to denigrate an entire faith system and to deny its followers the same access to the judicial system enjoyed by citizens of other creeds. Attorney, law professor, and self-styled Sharia expert Abed Awad also wants everyone to rest easy, writing in The Nation that we should get used to Sharia as just another benefit of globalization. The true story of Sharia in American courts is not one of a plot for imminent takeover, but rather another part of the tale of globalization. Marriages, divorces, corporations, and commercial transactions are global, meaning that U.S. courts must regularly interpret and apply foreign law. Islamic law has been considered by American courts in everything from the recognition of foreign divorces and custody decrees to the validity of marriages, the enforcement of money judgments, and the awarding of damages in commercial disputes and negligence matters. Who needs a constitution or sovereignty when we can just regularly interpret and apply foreign law? As we saw earlier, Sharia is Allah's law, an eternal, unchangeable, and all-encompassing way, a moral and legal code that prescribes everything down to the minutiae of daily life. There are varying interpretations, but Sharia is something that all Muslims are expected to follow, wherever they live, and it must take precedence over the laws of man. Abdur Rahman Doi, a Malaysian scholar of Islamic law, explains that the Quran mandates that Sharia rule over all Muslims everywhere for all time. The entire Muslim Ummah, community, lives under the Sharia, to which every member has to submit, with sovereignty belonging to Allah alone. Sharia was not revealed for limited application for a specific age. It will suit every age and time. Imran Asan Khan Niazi, a Pakistani law professor, contends that only Sharia can properly govern Muslims. Any other legal system, howsoever attractive it may appear on the surface, is alien for Muslims and is not likely to succeed in the solution of their problems. That presumably includes American constitutional law, at least according to the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America, AMJA, an organization of scholars and clerics that issues fatawa, the plural of fatwa, meaning religious formal opinions or rulings, according to the rulings of Sharia for Muslims living in America and the West. At their fifth convention held in Bahrain in November 2007, AMJA decreed, Allah sent His messengers and revealed His books for people to stand forth with justice. The way to do this is to judge by His laws, to stand up for pure justice and to renounce all the vain desires and human arrangements that go against it. Therefore, it is not lawful to seek judgment from man-made courts of law unless there is a complete lack of Islamic alternatives. Muslims are given permission to use secular courts by necessity, but Sharia is still established as supreme. In addition, Muslims in the West must find ways to follow Sharia however possible. It is incumbent upon Muslim communities to try to solve their disputes by compromising within the limits of Sharia judgment and by seeking out ways that are legal in their countries of residence, which would enable them to judge by Islamic law. One of AMJA's senior permanent fatwa committee members, Dr. Walid Al-Manis of the Islamic University of Minnesota, counseled that a Muslim who becomes a judge in America should understand the Sharia in such a manner as to be able to rule by it in every case brought before him, or at least as close as he's able to. He also must in his heart hate the man-made law. The Quran, Hadith, and a consensus of Islamic scholars suggest that Muslims should respect Sharia law over the laws of whatever nation they happen to live in. That shouldn't come as a surprise. What should shock us, however, is that American courts have helped them accomplish this. The Center for Security Policy has identified at least 146 cases of Sharia law coming into conflict with American law. Here are just a few examples. SD v. MJR, New Jersey, 2010. A Muslim woman was denied a restraining order against her husband, who had repeatedly raped and beaten her. The husband asserted it was his right under Sharia law to have sex with his wife at any time, and the trial court held that since the husband believed he was exercising his religious right, he was not acting with criminal intent. Fortunately, this decision was reversed on appeal. In re. Marriage of Obeidi, Washington State, 2010, a Muslim woman who was divorcing her husband demanded that he pay her $20,000 under a prenuptial agreement made in accordance with Sharia law. This agreement, however, had been written in Farsi, which the husband did not understand. Despite this fact, the trial court, specifically citing Islamic law, demanded the husband pay the $20,000. This was reversed on appeal, and the trial court was found to have erred by looking to Islamic law. In re, Marriage of Malak, California, 1986. A Muslim couple from Lebanon moved to the United Arab Emirates. A few years later, the wife left for America with their two children and eventually filed for divorce in sole custody in California. A Sharia court in Lebanon, however, gave custody to the husband, and he asked the California court to enforce this decision. The lower court refused, but on appeal, custody was granted to the husband in Lebanon when the California appellate court appeared to defer to the Sharia court. This shows that the appeals process cannot always be relied upon. Perhaps most troubling, in February 2015, the city of Irving, Texas, which is where my studios are located, found itself in the center of a national controversy. The North Texas Islamic Tribunal had established itself as a Sharia court in Irving. I sat down with two of the tribunal's three judges, and while they claimed their authority was limited, they offered some troubling views. One of the judges even praised harsh Sharia punishments like cutting off the hands of thieves, because if he feels my hands were cut because of that, he will think about this 100 times. He will never do it. The Irving City Council responded by passing a resolution officially recognizing the U.S. Constitution as the law of the land, and yet it passed by only a 5-4 vote. Why? Seemingly because four of the city council members were more afraid of appearing politically incorrect than they were committed to preserving the integrity of America's laws. These council members would be wise to study Great Britain, which, by one estimate, had more than 80 Sharia courts in 2009. Most of these deal with marriage and family issues, with many of the cases brought by women. A 2013 BBC investigation found that Islamic rulings given here are not always in the interest of the women concerned and can run counter to British law. They cited examples of British Sharia courts ordering women to go back to abusive marriages or to give up custody of their children to violent spouses. Back in the United States, the Sharia judges in Texas told local media that they've received calls from all over the country from other Muslim leaders looking to set up their own courts. Irving's mayor, Beth Van Dyne, sees where all of this is likely headed. Our nation cannot be so overly sensitive in defending other cultures that we stop protecting our own, she said. Unfortunately, that seems to be exactly what's happening. Being labeled a conspiracy theorist or an Islamophobe is so scary to most people that they won't even raise their hand to affirm that, yes, our Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Political correctness is beating common sense. Once the floodgates open, once a viable system of Sharia courts is allowed to operate and coexist with U.S. law, there will be no going back. At that point, they won't say we are conspiracy theorists anymore. They'll just say we were right. Lie number 6. The caliphate is a fanciful dream. When Glenn Beck rants about the caliphate taking over the Middle East from Morocco to the Philippines and lists the connections between caliphate promoters and the American left, he brings to mind no one so much as Robert Welch and the John Birch Society. Bill Kristol, Weekly Standard, February 2011. Our strategy is shaped by a deeper understanding of al-Qaeda's goals, strategy, and tactics that we have gained over the last decade. I'm not talking about al-Qaeda's grandiose vision of global domination through a violent Islamic caliphate. That vision is absurd, and we are not going to organize our counterterrorism policies against a feckless delusion that is never going to happen. John Brennan, Director of Central Intelligence, June 2011. No, I don't believe that at all. White House spokesman Josh Earnest, when asked, "Do you believe that ISIS has established something of a caliphate?" Grandiose, absurd, a feckless delusion, never going to happen. That's what John Brennan, a longtime counterterrorism advisor to the Obama and Bush administrations and current director of the CIA, had to say about the idea that a caliphate might be pitching its tent in some hellhole on the other side of the planet. Bill Kristol, neocon scribe and architect of Alan Key's feckless campaign for the Senate, attacked me a few years back for daring to suggest that Islamist radicals had ambitions to create a caliphate. Now, in 2015, an estimated 6 million people in Syria and Iraq find themselves living under what U.S. News and World Report, as well as other outlets, has termed the militant's caliphate. So what exactly is a caliphate? As discussed in Chapter 3, the term has been used to describe Islamic empire since the 7th century A.D. When the Prophet Muhammad died in 632, his father-in-law, Abu Bakr, was appointed the first caliph, or successor, to rule over the followers and territory that Muhammad had amassed. Throughout many different rulers and succession disputes, the original caliphate's borders expanded and contracted over time until 1258, when its last capital, Baghdad, fell to Mongol invaders. Shortly thereafter, the Ottoman Turks established a new caliphate based in Constantinople, before it disintegrated in the wake of the empire's defeat in World War I. Hope for restoring the caliphate was rekindled in 1928 when Hassan al-Banna started the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. According to terrorism researcher Stephen Coughlin, Albana viewed the end of the caliphate as a calamity that highlighted how far the Islamic world had strayed from the true message and governing system of Islam. Albana was not shy about announcing his group's goal. "It is the nature of Islam to dominate, not to be dominated," the godfather of modern Islamist terrorist groups said, "to impose its law on all nations and to extend its power to the entire planet." ISIS realized this vision on June 28, 2014, by formally establishing a caliphate, almost 3 years to the day after CIA Director Brennan's assurances that it would never happen. In their official statement that day, ISIS announced that they had gained the essentials necessary for khilifa, caliphate, which the Muslims are sinful for if they do not try to establish. Muslims around the world faced damnation if they did not fulfill their religious duty to support the new state, according to ISIS. They elevated their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to the position of Imam and Khalifa, Caliph, for the Muslims everywhere. He was now to be called Caliph Ibrahim. The captain of the JV squad apparently woke up one morning and dubbed himself leader of the Islamic world. Anyone surprised by this, and there are plenty, has simply not been paying attention. In 2005, members of the Bush administration and military leaders told us about terrorist dreams for a caliphate. They talk about wanting to reestablish what you could refer to as the 7th century caliphate, Vice President Dick Cheney warned, governed by Sharia law, the most rigid interpretation of the Quran. Similarly, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld warned that Iraq would serve as the base of a new Islamic caliphate to extend throughout the Middle East, and which would threaten legitimate governments in Europe, Africa, and Asia. And then there was this from General John Abizaid, the commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East. "They will try to reestablish a caliphate throughout the entire Muslim world, just as we had the opportunity to learn what the Nazis were going to do from Hitler's world in Mein Kampf. We need to learn what these people intend to do from their own words." But the mainstream media would have none of it. The New York Times, among others on the left, took great umbrage at the idea of a caliphate. In 2005, the Times wrote that a number of scholars and former government officials take strong issue with the administration's warning about a new caliphate and compare it to the fear of communism spread during the Cold War. They say that although al-Qaeda's statements do indeed describe a caliphate as a goal, the administration is exaggerating the magnitude of the threat. The Times also quoted Shibli Telhami, Anwar Sadat professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland, who assured readers, "There's no chance in the world that they'll succeed, it's a silly threat." Yet, here we are. Each week, the Islamic State's caliphate controls an area larger than Great Britain. With nearly every passing day, it absorbs more cities and villages in Iraq and Syria. To date, this desert heartland of the caliphate puts the Islamic State in control of more than 6 million people. The caliphate continues to expand into oil-rich areas, which provide millions of dollars in funding for increased terrorist activity and expansion. And unlike most pure terrorist organizations, ISIS governs the territory it captures, providing water, roads, and a justice system operated under Sharia law. From Libya to Egypt to Yemen and Nigeria, it has far-flung cells operating in more than a dozen countries with outposts where it governs pockets of territory. The term caliphate has deep meaning and cultural resonance for Muslims around the world. While it's true that the vast majority of them do not recognize the legitimacy of the caliphate established by the Islamic State, it has attracted a steady stream of recruits and other means of support as the fulfillment of a political vision that was erased from the face of the earth for 90 years. The new caliphate is becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy as Islamist radicals flock to join a weak but Allah-ordained political entity destined to spread to the corners of the earth. Osama bin Laden once said, "When people see a strong horse and a weak horse, by nature they will like the strong horse." As the caliphate expands and the West does nothing to stand in its way, it's pretty clear that hundreds of thousands of Muslim youths see the strong horse and want to be part of the winning team. It's also important to remember why the caliphate is so important in the first place. It's a necessary step to bring about the return of the Mahdi, the final successor to Muhammad before the Day of Judgment. Islamists do not want money, power, or land. All of these things are necessary, but they are a means to an end. That end is nothing less than the end times themselves. We know that extremists have had a very specific plan to achieve this goal in place for years. As Chapter 4 describes, Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda, and its ISIS allies have a detailed 7-stage vision, which was published in 2005. Their strategy anticipated a U.S. response to 9/11 that would draw America into war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and successfully predicted the so-called Arab Spring, when secular governments would topple, and the creation of an Islamic caliphate sometime between 2013 and 2016, years before they actually occurred. Phase 7, to be completed by 2020, is when 1.5 billion Muslims join the caliphate, ensuring its definitive victory. Given their track record so far, the predicted caliphate arrived right on time, we have every reason to take them seriously. The Islamic State has been ground zero for some of the worst crimes against humanity in modern times. Sexual slavery, mass executions, and beheadings are broadcast around the world. They use the Quran and Sharia to justify their actions and to govern the territory they control under their self-declared caliphate. They do not kill and conquer in their own name, but in the name of Allah. The question of whether any of this is legitimate in the eyes of other Muslims is irrelevant. The Islamic State does not need or care about recognition as a true caliphate from anyone else. It will continue to act like one and grow as one until, according to their plan, they have more than 1 billion Muslims under their control and the rest of the world is powerless to stop them. Lie number 7. Islam is tolerant toward non-Muslims. Throughout history, Islam has demonstrated through words and deeds the possibilities of religious tolerance and racial equality. Islam has a proud tradition of tolerance. President Barack Obama in Cairo, 2009. If Islam's sole interest is the welfare of mankind, then Islam is the strongest advocate of human rights anywhere on earth. Hip-hop artist and actor Mos Def. Never in its history did Islam compel a single human being to change his faith. Muslim Brotherhood theorist Saeed Qutb. You're probably familiar with that purple coexist bumper sticker, the one where the C is an Islamic crescent, symbolizing the unshakable Muslim commitment to peace and interfaith dialogue. It's a familiar refrain one heard over and over again from Islamists and their apologists alike. Islam's history is one of cooperation and peaceful coexistence with non-Muslims. Like so much of the material in the Quran and Islamic law, teachings on how to treat Christians, Jews, and other unbelievers often appear murky and contradictory. But, as discussed earlier, these teachings become painfully clear if you know where to look, and know which later Medinan passages replace the earlier, more peaceful Meccan ones. The abrogative structure, meaning that verses in the Quran from an earlier time period are superseded as doctrine by verses revealed by Muhammad at a later time, makes Allah's true message easy to spot. All non-Muslims must be subdued. Like many of the more brutal elements of Islam, the persecution of non-Muslims at the hands of Islamist fanatics has seen a resurgence as the global jihad movement has gained strength. Barbarism toward and murder of non-believers became the law of the land in the Islamic State Caliphate, after it announced that Christians were legitimate targets for death. Dabiq, the Islamic State's official propaganda magazine, has listed the Jews, the Christians, the Rafida, Shia, and the proponents of democracy as its main enemies deserving of jihad. Many Muslims are, of course, tolerant and pluralistic people, proud citizens of the 21st century who realize that medieval-style religious persecution has no place in the world today. But the fact remains that the Quran and Islamic law contain ample justification for subjugating non-Muslims to Muslim power. Our enemies acknowledge this justification openly. We ignore it at our peril. It should be apparent to anyone listening to this book that the Quran itself often works against those who present a benevolent, tolerant image of Islam. In this case, however, the Quran seems to have given them evidence to back up their views. It is found in Surah 2. There is no compulsion in religion. Verily, the right path has become distinct from the wrong path. Quran 2:256. This seems nice and pluralistic. The very first phrase, "there is no compulsion in religion," is seized upon by some.